right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and this is going to be really unusual. It's going to be a very quick opening. Toward the back end of the show, you'll be listening to the second installment of the series I'm working on called Getting Down to Basics with the People of Sanford, Florida. And that's about introducing the work, vision, and leadership of Bob Avakian to people all over the country and bringing forward a movement for revolution nationwide. But starting the show off, I want you to sit back for a minute and just take in the words that you're about to hear, and then we'll go right in to our first guest.
What do you think life would be like if you were a top-level surgeon? You were a surgeon who was working at one of the most prestigious universities, hospitals in the world, one of the most prestigious medical schools in the world, and you were a surgeon who was once voted most innovative surgeon by Black Enterprise, who also launched UCLA's Johnson Cancer Center Tumor Lab, and who got an award from the National Institutes of Health for its faculty development. Now imagine that you're a surgeon and a teacher and you're at that university. What do you think life would be like? Now stop and think, what if I said you were a Black surgeon and teacher at that university, at that medical school, at UCLA's medical school? What do you think life would be like? Well, I can almost guarantee you that you won't come anywhere near to what the reality is, and the reality that's going to be described by my guest, Dr. Christian Head. Dr. Christian Head is a surgeon and a professor at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. He's in the Department of Head and Neck Surgery, and he's here to tell us about what happened to him, a lawsuit that he filed against UCLA, and the discrimination and racism that has tortured him for quite some time. Dr. Head, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on the show today.
I just did this whole little thing about what I thought about it. Why don't you tell people what life is like for you as a Black physician? Because that's the key word, I think, in here, is a Black physician teaching at one of these universities. What's life like for you?
Well, I think there are always hurdles at some of these larger universities, but things really became bad when I was at a graduation party for the head and neck residents. It was close to 250 people there, parents, residents, medical students, faculty, and they had a what tends to be a light roast of residents and then a roast of some of the faculty members. But this particular roast seemed to be focused on me, described me as a irresponsible physician, a poor surgeon having to rely on others. And then they placed the final slide, which was my head was photographed, photoshopped onto a gorilla with a Caucasian man behind me sodomizing me, and my boss's head with a smile on it on the person. And, I heard laughter and groans. I felt like someone had just stabbed me, and I tried to compose myself. I didn't want to have a large outburst, and I confronted my boss minutes later when the laughter subsided, and I said, "How do you let this happen?" And his response was, "What's the problem?" The following day, I approached him again and said, "Those individuals need to be punished. This is outrageous." And his response was almost like, kind of, get over it. And I think as I reported this incident to officials, every time I reported an incident, there was a retaliation, and it became worse and worse. And the lack of response by the university has forced me to do this action.
Well, let me ask you this, because I think it's actually really important for people to understand. You know, when you say that you went to your superiors, you went to the people in your workplace that are actually your, next up bosses and whatnot, and you basically said, "Look, I'm being wronged here." What was their response?
There was okay, it happened. So there wasn't a response. But then there was a series of events that occurred that I quickly realized they're retaliation in nature. I was in the midst of getting tenure. And when I reported to certain individuals, they said to me, "Look, if you want tenure, you need to focus on getting tenure. If you bring this up, you will never get tenure. You'll be crushed." My dream, I'm the first physician in my family. My dream is always to be an academic surgeon at a prominent university. I have no family in California. I came here because I thought UCLA was the best. I trained here for over 8 years, and I had options to go to a number of other universities, but I chose UCLA because of my relationship with the Johnson Cancer Center and the division chief and Hemonc. I thought it would be a good relationship to start my career. Unfortunately, what happened, and certainly what happened on that day when they showed that slide, was not one of those things I could back down. I very easily could have left in the cloak of darkness and possibly have received some type of small settlement of some sort. But I worked, and my family sacrificed many years for me to have the opportunity to be at the university. I feel I deserve that right. It's a public university.
We're speaking with Dr. Christian Head, who is a surgeon and professor at UCLA's School of Medicine, and we're talking about the discrimination and racism that has been hurled at him from the highest levels of the UCLA School of Medicine, and the lawsuit that he's filed because of that. Now, Dr. Head, you raised that while this outrageously racist slideshow was the high point, it was the thing that really poked out of the water, something built on a whole context of an ongoing series of what, you know, can only be described as racial harassment that had dogged you from early on in your career at UCLA. You know, can you tell people about that? Because I don't want people to just walk away thinking, okay, so there was these, you know, in a certain sense, oh, everybody's partying, you know, and then this is, then his superior looks at him and says, oh, get over it. Well, this is what they say to black people all the time. Get over it. You want to talk about discrimination. You want to talk about, you know, terror unleashed against black people. Get over it. Come on. Those days are gone. You know, everything's equal. Everything's fine now. And you say, you actually say, and you depict a long history of humiliating assaults in one way or another while you were at UCLA. Can you tell our audience about that?
For anyone to be successful at a university, there's going to be hurdles. And some hurdles and battles aren't worth fighting because the objective really is to exceed. And for me, it was to get tenure. Early on in my career at the university, I started in 2002. One particular faculty member, Dr. Marilyn Wong, said some very offensive things, that I was affirmative active reject, that I belonged at MLK, that blacks cannot run hospitals. Martin Luther King Hospital is a perfect example. You know, King Drew Medical Center is the reason why they're having so much problems. These are all things that I reported early on about this confrontation, about what she had said to me. Now, it was my understanding that the university, at that time Dean Friedman, had admonished her, but yet when Dean Friedman unfortunately had passed away, the retaliation became much more intense and much more severe. These acts involved dropping my salary for over a two-month period. I only received 48 cents in compensation at the university. These are things not only had an impact on me directly, but caused severe economic hardships for my family, which I have two young kids and did not deserve this. They put my home in jeopardy for being repossessed. When you're used to a certain income and your salary drops to 48 cents, it wreaks havoc on the budget, especially over a two-month period. And at the time this occurred was when the economy was at its worst, 2008, and the ability to use retirement as a possibility of staying afloat, those are all things that were affected.
Well, you know, it's incredible. You think about that, and the impact on you, but also the impact on the people that you're serving, you know, in the sense of, you know, not just your kids and your family and you, that's bad enough, but it also must have had an impact on your ability to actually treat patients, which is what you became a doctor to do in the first place, and to teach students. You know, that must have been impacted severely, too.
Well, for one thing, it's hard enough to be, everyone works hard in the medical profession and other professions, and it's hard enough to just be a professor, but if you can imagine if you have to suffer a sudden economic hardship, and as I complained about, I think a reasonable complaint that my salary should be corrected, they started isolating me. Residents were told not to work with me. It's not unusual to have residents not show up to my cases. A part of my responsibility at a university is not only to perform, you know, high-level surgery and do it well, which I do, but to teach. And that opportunity to teach has essentially been removed from me and eventually will have an impact on my ability to progress within the university.
So you're not allowed to teach anywhere now?
Well, it's not that they don't allow me. They don't give me the opportunity. The residents routinely do not show up at my operations. And I have complained about this. I've sent multiple notices to the chancellor and to the dean. Eugene Washington and others. And, you know, I was told that the residents can select who they want to go with, but just by averages, the number of surgeries I do within a year, it's less than 1% that I get residents for those cases. Certain cases I do require, because of the complexity, require more than one person at a high level within the surgery. Now, in those cases, are difficult to do if I have no one show up to the operating room except for nurses in the OR and anesthesiologists. Now, what I've had to do more recently is I call other attendings who would be willing to come in and we do the surgery together. But that defeats the purpose of why I'm at a university. The residents could stand to learn from a surgeon like me.
We're talking to Dr. Christian Head, surgeon and professor at the UCLA School of Medicine, and we're talking about the racism and humiliation and degradation that he's had to endure during his time teaching at UCLA School of Medicine. Now, tell me something. I'm still a little confused on this, too, because what the hell did the university say? I mean, you're describing 48-cent checks and the rest of the stuff, and it seems like, you know, somewhere they gotta offer a plausible explanation for what's going on or some recourse to you.
I spent close to 2 days giving very detailed information to the investigator in the chancellor's office, Ms. Tomlinson, and going into exquisite detail about a number of these type of issues. And I went through the financial aspects. I went through a number of the retaliatory aspects. But more importantly, which I thought would be the easiest thing for the university to approve and deal with, was the gorilla. I went into exquisite detail about the gorilla, where it happened, and so forth. They essentially told me that the gorilla didn't exist, and that when other witnesses came forward, in particular, one of the witnesses came forward with a full professor, he was told multiple times the gorilla does not exist, and that all the things I have said are just aren't true. But we're finding out now that the evidence points, I mean, there was over close to 250 people who witnessed the gorilla. So it's difficult to say that never happened. And there are witnesses now who have come forward and who have given statements that the gorilla does exist and gone into detail about that event. University stance has been essentially no response. All I've received from the chancellor is that my accusations are salacious. Well, I wish he could describe. I don't know how he would describe that slide. I think I was very technical in describing that slide in the event. I don't see how you could describe that slide any other way.
It seems amazing that this would be going on in the sense of people not being able to, you know, go to them and say, look, this is what's happening. This is what happened at this event. 250 people saw it. What the hell are you doing? How can you tell me that this didn't happen? You know, I've even seen depictions of the thing on, I can't remember where it was, but I saw some depiction of it. And I thought, okay, when you say that they say it didn't happen, it's kind of amazing because I know they say that their allegation, they talk about your complaint that you filed as a list of unproven and unprovable allegations, you know, and they basically pose the question to people who don't know anything about this case or who may be somewhat naive or just have their eyes closed as to what it's like to be a black person in America today. They say, well, you know, he's made these unfounded allegations and while he certainly has the choice and the right to go to the courts, we really hoped that he would have gone through all the channels. And they make it seem like you decided to say, ah, to hell with it. I'm just going to buck the channels and go out and get for me.
Well, you know something, you know, I really thought it was despicable. It was humiliating, that particular slide. And it's not unusual, as you're probably aware, to depict African-American males with their heads on gorillas who are in leadership positions. It happened to President Obama. It's happened to a number of others. As a matter of fact, one of the leading experts is a professor at the university, Professor Goff. You might consider having him on your show and discussing some of the questions about these depictions. It was meant to not only humiliate me, but to dehumanize me, to portray me as subhuman. It was a very well-thought-out slide, and the fact that my boss was smiling while he was sodomizing me, I think says it all. And his actions over that period of time were despicable. And the university, for them to call me saying that I'm making salacious statements, is horrible. I should have the right to report, as a junior faculty, I should have the right to report malfeasance and have a reasonable investigation and be protected while I'm reporting these things. Instead, I was retaliated against. My salary was dropped over a two-month period. This had profound impact, isolating me, removing my opportunity to teach. When I do a big case, to protect my patients, because I took an oath, to protect my patients, I have to really think about it. Timing of the case, I have to make sure attendings are available to cover the case with me because I don't get the coverage from the university. That's basic coverage that all the other surgeons receive. And I'm considered a bad person because I have reported these things, and I'm sure I'm not the first.
We're talking with Dr. Christian Head, surgeon and professor at the UCLA School of Medicine, and we're talking about his case detailing racism, oppression, and discrimination that he suffered as a result of being black at UCLA. Now, Dr. Head, I read in your complaint where I guess it was actually this Dr. Burke. I read where he actually tried to shut you up. He offered you some kind of deal if you wouldn't go forward with this. Is that true?
Well, he phrased it in multiple ways at multiple occasions. There's one time he said to me, if you don't tell my secrets, I won't tell your secrets. And my response was that, go ahead and tell my secrets. I have no secrets to keep. It doesn't change the fact. On one of these occasions when he was talking to me, my niece, unfortunately, died in college. She was found dead in North Carolina. His response to that was she taking drugs? She was taking drugs, wasn't she? The verbal humiliation and his acts, I think, along with Marilyn Wong's acts, have been irresponsible. And what upsets me the most is, it's not only the depiction of being a gorilla. It's the university's lack of response. They're a public institution. I have every right, even though I'm the first African-American to head and neck surgeon, I have every right to be there. I have proven that I should be there because I'm tenured. I have passed the academic hurdles necessary to achieve tenure. They gave it to me. They went into a room. They reviewed my credentials. They made a decision, which was the rational decision, near unanimous, that I should be tenured. And then for this to come out, and then all of a sudden, people are making statements about, I'm an affirmative action reject?
That's where I wanted to go, actually, because that was one of the things that really, next to the gorilla image, what really, really got me just over the top was this whole idea of, for one thing, saying, well, you're an affirmative action appointee and you're affirmative action project, as if, number one, attempt to degrade you and your accomplishments. But then there's also the question of, all along, affirmative action is not a signal of somehow somebody's inferior, not able to do this. It was something that was fought for in the 1960s because the whole system of white supremacy has been keeping black people in particular out of getting anywhere in the society, and it still exists to this day. And to then turn around and try to make it seem like, well, you're trying to take unfair advantage of things. Now, most of it has even been demolished now.
All right, let me tell you, there are no African-American residents. We have one of the largest programs in the country. I can't tell you, I can't remember the last time we interviewed an African-American. Head and neck surgery produces a total of about 220 surgeons a year. It's one of the most selective specialties. I don't see them. If I'm an affirmative action project, well, affirmative action is not working because I'm the first at a public institution, the first African-American to be on faculty and trained there. I like to call firm action. Firm action is when you have a group of qualified individuals and you understand the importance of diversity and you just choose one of them as a qualified individual. But it takes an institution. You can't just discuss diversity. You have to take action. And part of making the commitment to have a diverse community is protecting the diverse community. It's not enough to talk about the rainbow if you're not going to bring them into an institution, and certainly if you're not going to protect them. And I think after this is all said and done, you're going to hear multiple examples of how people have been pushed out of the university. I'm just one of the few who stood up and fought. But I'm just one person going against a large corporation who wants to preserve its brand. Still believe, in many respects, there are some great aspects to the university. This is just not one of them.
But, you know, if you look at it overall, too, I was talking with somebody about it earlier today, and they said, look up the statistics for what's going on at UCLA. And, you know, when you look at the percentage of black students at UCLA, take a guess at what it is.
It's low.
Yeah, 3%. You know, and you think about that, and it really hits you as to what all is going on, this whole question of the increasing oppression of black people in this country. It's just phenomenal what's happening. I mean, you combine this with all of these things. And I wanted to ask you about this. And this is one of the things that the UCLA officials were always pointing out in their responses to you was, but we really love diversity. We uphold the diversity. We can talk things out. We can embrace each other. We can talk about the rainbow. And I think your point is very well taken. Really? But there's a whole thing here about how this ties in with everything else that has been going on in some of these places. From, I mean, look, the nooses on campus, you know, the slave auctions in the fraternities at UCLA not so long ago, the Lupe, the drunk Mexican whore parties that the fraternities used to have. One young guy told me at UCLA, he said he had never been called the N-word in his life so many times until he got to UCLA. This really points to something very, very terrible going on.
And that's why it's kind of interesting. It all falls back to this one episode of The Gorilla. And that's why when I talked about this, I said, it's a much bigger story. It's even bigger than I am. It encompasses the whole, it's a culture. It's a way of the university looks at the diverse population, or lack thereof. To profess that you want a community of diversity, but yet your numbers keep falling, it should tell them something. If I'm a qualified individual, and I'm applying to graduate school, medical school, or head and neck surgery, and I have a choice between UCLA or maybe some other prestigious university that will embrace African-Americans, who has a track record of seeing these African-Americans achieve, where are you going to go? It just makes sense.
We're talking with Dr. Christian Head, an African-American surgeon and professor at the UCLA School of Medicine, and we're talking about his life as a black surgeon at UCLA. Now, let me ask you this. I have a couple more questions for you, and one I'd say just to continue along these lines. In a certain sense, what's being done to you at UCLA actually, to me, was really sort of a metaphorical lynching.
Exactly. I'm being punished. They want to destroy me, every aspect of me. And, you know, their whole thing, I brought all of this into the chancellor's office, all the evidence behind this. Rather than just taking action and doing the right thing, they punish me. And then when I seek help, when I go out and seek help from others, and I'm forced to obtain representation, which is what a smart person would have done much sooner than what I did, then it's like, oh, we can't talk, we can't resolve this because it's a legal thing. We can't do anything, it's illegal. What they want to do is they want to drag this out, keep me in this environment that's extremely hostile, destroy any possibility of continuing my development as a surgeon and as a researcher, and then at that point, push me out of the university. So really, I had no choice but to do what I'm doing now.
And I think that point that you made earlier in the conversation about the dehumanization and the humiliation and dehumanization of you is actually pretty important in terms of not just because of you as the individual, but because of basically everything that's concentrated in that and how that plays out for how the society treats and looks at and views and encourages others to view black people.
The other point I wanted to make is that There are a lot of good people at the university. I have no doubt about it, because they've been reaching out to me when I walk through the university, especially upper campus. I have professors coming up to me saying that they support me, that it was wrong. I have a number of people within the School of Medicine, actually, who have said the same thing, but they fear retaliation. They fear if their name is linked to them questioning the university, that they would be severely punished. And these are very difficult times, and a number of people who've contacted me have rather not used their name and are trying to help with information from inside the university, but they fear retaliation. They fear losing their jobs. And they have the right to, because one of the eyewitnesses who came forward, a full professor, was retaliated against. And so several other individuals have now come forward, and they're seeking to get protection. They're anonymous for now, but they will come forward once the proceedings start. And I think it's a shame, because I think there's a lot more people in the university that would want to come public and question this, but they fear retaliation.
Well, you know, somebody told me that they had talked to people that were talking about stepping out in support of you and wanting to issue statements and things like that, and they actually had been warned. They got phone calls from university officials warning them that that wasn't a wise thing to do, and also that their emails suddenly started getting monitored.
Well, you know, that doesn't really surprise me. especially in the medical profession, it's very conservative environment. Physicians typically don't get excited about much, but they're pretty animated about what happens to me. The other thing, too, is I always thought of myself as a professor, you know, associate professor at the UCLA, that somehow I had a cloak of protection from the university because I was one of the valued few, and they're not protecting me. I think they're going to find out that I'm right, and as more material comes out, as more evidence comes out, you'll see that the evidence that's coming out is supporting me and supporting exactly what I said. And my story has always been the same. A number of their stories have changed. And an example of that is 48 cents compensation over a two-month period. It just happened to occur at the same time I was being retaliated against a number of events. It's a difficult thing to explain. The fact that they would try to explain it and say a gorilla doesn't exist explains why I have chosen the route I have chosen. How could I trust a university if they will not even acknowledge the event where I was depicted, my head was depicted on the gorilla? I mean, where is the sense of fairness?
We're speaking with Dr. Christian Head, who is a surgeon and professor at UCLA's School of Medicine, and we're talking about the discrimination and racism that has been hurled at him from the highest levels of the UCLA School of Medicine and the lawsuit that he's filed because of that. Well, you know, one thing I wanted to ask you about, too, is I know that there seemed to be a lot of support growing on the UCLA campus. I know that various student groups and some faculty members and whatnot have signed a petition in support of you. And I know your YouTube piece just went viral, which I was really glad to see.
Yeah, I was. There is a civil rights leader, Willis Edwards. He's a great person. If you know him, he's heavily involved in NAACP. He was a founder of the NAACP Image Awards. He produced the movie, The Rosa Parks Story, and was responsible for the funding of her monument. He heard my story and started that petition and linked it to the YouTube piece. It's on change.org. And there's been over 110,000 signatures supporting me and petitioning the university to stop this practice and to give me justice. I'm getting emails from 130 different countries who are supporting me. People are sending me books, prayers in every religion that you can imagine trying to support me. I need help, but even if that help does not come in the form of justice, I will not stop my pursuit to expose what has happened to me. I think one of the only ways you're really going to get to the cusp of what happened at the university and with these things is probably outside investigation. Maybe the Justice Department needs to come in and investigate this. They would have subpoena power to be able to subpoena all these individuals, and then let's see who's telling the truth. I have a feeling it would take that type of organization coming from the outside. Either that or Lieutenant Governor Pamela Ms. Harris, Attorney Harris, if she brought in her resources to investigate this. That's one of the only ways you're going to get down to what truthfully happened. When you start subpoenaing people and asking them to take an oath, some people will lie, but I think you'd be surprised. Some people are going to tell the truth. I don't have the resources to subpoena all these people, but a federal agency might.
Well, if I were you, I wouldn't count too much on that happening because, yeah. You know, you look at what's going on in this country right now, what the history of this country is, what's going on with it right now, even the way that oppressed nationalities are constantly being hit harder and harder and harder. And I was thinking as you're talking, you know, look, there's Trayvon Martin, who was gunned down and it was, you know, whitewashed and sweat. They tried to sweep it under the rug and they weren't able to only because people stood up and said, no, we're not going to let this happen. And Trayvon was, I mean, I was down in Sanford, Florida a little while ago and talked to people that in the complex he lived at and other people in the city of Sanford and in Goldsboro, the black neighborhood down there. And they told me what life was like for black people in Sanford. And I kept thinking about Trayvon's face. And here's this kid. If you saw this kid's face anywhere else, football player, an angelic, sweet face that was just sort of changing from a kid into an adult, you know, and he, even as you look at it, and you just have to imagine him laying face down in the grass, gasping for his last breath, because why? He was a young black kid walking through a housing complex, not 70 feet away from where he was staying, and he was gunned down by somebody who thought he looked suspicious. How different is that between what they did there around Trayvon and what they've done to you?
Well, first of all, I like to say my prayers for the Martin family. When I heard about that, I have two daughters, and I can't even. It's difficult for me to compare my situation with the hardship that the Martin family has gone through. I couldn't imagine losing one of my daughters in that way. Mm-hmm. And I know that their family will never receive anything close to having their son back. I hope there is justice. But I think the theme of some of the things that have occurred, you know, thinking of us as not really being whole, as one person, being less valued than others, I think that in general, that's the theme. And I should be valued. I'm not asking to be valued more than any other individual. As a matter of fact, most of the people who have come forward to support me, a large number of them are African American. The community has been solid. But it has been every type, Caucasians, you know, Asians. A lot of the student groups across all the groups came to support me. And I think that gave me a lot of hope for the future. Because evidently they got it, they understand, and some of the older people don't understand. Until the university is willing to truly investigate this, acknowledge the truth, and deal with it in a professional way, they're hopeless. They're always going to have problems dealing with this.
All right, Dr. Head, we're going to have to wrap it up, but I want to ask you one thing just to emphasize to people what the situation is. You are the only tenured African-American doctor in the Department of Head and Neck Surgery?
That's correct.
How many tenured doctors, African-American doctors, are there in the entire medical school?
Well, as far as surgeons, is my colleague, Dr. Langston Hawley, excellent surgeon. He's in neurosurgery. Isla Garraway, she's not tenured yet. She's in urology, but I'm sure she'll be tenured at some point, whether it's at UCLA or another institution. So there's two in surgery, in the specialties of surgery, neurosurgery and head and neck surgery, and probably a handful, maybe there's less than 6 or 7. There's a number of what's called non-tenured or clinical faculty, but they tend to be affiliated with other institutions. So the numbers are small. Out of 200 surgeons, you're really talking about, three.
Wow. Amazing. And that says a hell of a lot. Dr. Head, thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Okay, and talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
Take care. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we've been talking with Dr. Christian Head, surgeon and professor at the UCLA School of Medicine, and we've been talking about the horrible racism and degradation that he's had to put up with during his time as a tenured professor at UCLA's School of Medicine. And if you want to sign the petition in support of Dr. Christian Head, go to change.org, Christian Head, UCLA Discrimination, and you can sign the petition to the chancellor's office right there. Add your name. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to jump right into part two of my series, Getting Down to Basics with the People of Sanford, so stay tuned. May, I joined the Basics bus tour as it rolled into Sanford, Florida, the town where Trayvon Martin was killed. The tour brought the work and vision of Bob Avakian and his book Basics into Sanford, and I spent my time in the black neighborhood of Goldsboro talking with the people about their lives and digging into the deep questions of how to change things. Now, there were a lot of people who were receptive to this, but it actually took work. It took work to dig into those big questions. It took work to struggle with people around what were the various alternatives out there? And all this work opened up the beginnings of a movement for revolution in Sanford, Florida, as part of a growing movement across the country. For more information on the Basics Bus Tour, go to basicsbustour.tumblr.com. That's that's what struck me the most about the look and the feel of Central Florida. After living in L.A. for a long time, I'm like a kid in a candy store when I come up on a whole lot of big, full-on oak and cypress trees, their branches and leaves throwing up a natural canopy to help you get through those humid and way too damn hot days. And then there's the Spanish moss, hanging down off the branches of these trees like silver-gray beards. And when tiny flowers start to bloom on the moss, little red specks in all that gray, kind of like blood. That's when it hits me. Trees carry with them a whole different meaning for black people in Sanford and other parts of Central Florida. When a soft wind passes through these trees, it's not the soothing whoosh sound of the surface of leaves gently passing over one another that black people hear. Instead, it's more like a brittle clacking, the sound of dried bones that have been hanging there for centuries, banging into one another. After all, as Bob Avakian has so sharply pointed out, the Bible Belt in the U.S. is also the lynching belt. And all these great, beautiful trees draped in Spanish moss are also lynching trees. In the Goldsboro neighborhood of Sanford, one of the historic black neighborhoods, it's striking how many people have a lynching story. Samuel is a middle-aged, middle-class black man living with his family in a well-kept little house with a well-kept lawn in Goldsboro. Samuel teaches in a local school. He's a striver in a terribly downpressed town. He has a rock-bottom belief that the system works. Or at least it works for those who know how to work the system. Samuel believes that things will get better once black people get into the system and learn how to work it. He stands at his door wearing a green and black striped polo shirt, neatly pressed pants, and slip-on shoes. Samuel moved to Sanford from another part of Central Florida a little less than 10 years ago. When I approached him to talk with me, Samuel looked out at the Basics bus and wanted to know what it was and what all the commotion was about. We talked for a few minutes, and as we stood there, I noticed a black man about Samuel's age riding past the bus on an old 1960s-style cruiser bicycle. Not once, but a few times, carefully checking everything out. On his last pass-by, he looked over, nodded, and rode off in the opposite direction. Samuel commented that we were attracting attention, and soon the conversation turned to the murder of Trayvon Martin. I read Samuel Basics 113, the No More Generations quote that's a big part of the message that this tour is carrying with it. No more generations of our youth, here and all around the world, whose life is over, whose fate has been sealed, who have been condemned to an early death or a life of misery and brutality, whom the system has destined for oppression and oblivion, even before they are born. I say no more of that. Samuel started talking about his thoughts on what was behind the murder of Trayvon and how it's been handled by the authorities.
That it was just a litmus test to see if they could get away with a modern day lynching. Because in Central Florida, lynchings have been taking place for a long time. And a lot of the lynchings that took place in history have been done by law enforcement. It's been done from as long as I can remember. And one of the most notorious lynchmen was Sheriff McCall over in Lake County.
What was his name?
Sheriff McCall. He was the sheriff of Lake County.
Son. blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
Samuel got quiet and tense. He took a deep breath before he went on with his story.
I was 6 years old. I didn't go to school that day because I was sick. And I was dropped off at my grandmother's house. My grandmother had to go to work. So I was with my grandfather. And he was picking fruit at that time. So we drove out to the Claremont area. And he pulled up into the orange grove. And he stopped, and when he stopped, it was more like a pensive stop. And he saw police cars there, and he basically knew something was wrong. So he got out of the car, and he told me, he said, whatever you do, do not look out of the car. Get in the back and stay down, regardless of what you see or hear. So I knew that something was wrong. And then he started yelling, strange fruit, to the other workers that were around. And when I peeked over the back of the station wagon window, I saw that Sheriff McCall and his deputies had hung a black man, and he told me, and I know he told me not to peek or not to look and to stay down, but I looked and I saw what was going on, and I also saw Sheriff McCall brutalize my grandfather and the workers that were out there, and told them that you better not say nothing, nigga, or else. And that was the warning that we all heard and that we grew up with.
Samuel's face was tense. He took a minute to pull himself together again and then brought things back to the murder of Trayvon.
Yes. I've told everybody, this is a litmus test to see what they can get away with. And what I mean by they, I'm not talking about just the police force, but I'm talking about white men in general, because everybody that was in charge of that investigation was white. The state attorney, the chief of police, the detective that was on duty at that time, even though he wasn't a homicide detective, he was a narcotics detective. The homicide detective didn't respond to the shooting. It was a narcotics detective, which was wrong in the first place. Because if you have a shooting and it's a death, it should be a homicide detective that responds.
Why do you think they sent a narcotics detective?
Because it was a black child. Anytime that there is a shooting involved, and it's a shooting involving somebody black, it's always assumed that drugs are involved. So They normally just roll out a narcotics detective because they assume that it's a criminal, you know, criminal mischief involved in the first place. So that's what they were most likely assuming.
I asked Samuel when he saw the lynching that he told me about. He said it was in 1968 and that lynchings were still going on in Central Florida at that time. He told me that the coloreds only signs weren't removed from the water fountains in the Greyhound bus station until the late 1970s.
Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to sup, for the sun to rot, for the tree to drop. Strange and bitter cry.
I looked over toward the Basics bus, and one of the volunteers was on the sound system reading Basics 113, breaking it down and talking about revolution and communism and why people have to be checking out Bob Avakian and becoming part of this movement for revolution. Samuel stared at the bus for a bit and listened to some of the agitation. Then he turned to me and said,
I say you're asking for trouble here in Seminole County because this is a area where it's a good old boy system, and if you buck against the system, you're going to be hurt.
I pointed out to Samuel that people in Sanford had stood up when the system justified and tried to sweep under the carpet the murder of Trayvon. I commented that it's not just the color of your skin or the good old boy system that's the problem, but it's the bigger system of capitalism and imperialism that's built on the foundation of white supremacy that's the problem, and that's what we have to deal with. Samuel responded quick.
Because we're tired of it. We're tired of it, and we're not going to stand for it any longer. You're right.
Yeah. Tell me about what you think about that.
Well, like you said, it's more than just the color of the skin, because not all white men are evil and not all black men are good. So you have to think about where do we go from here? We have to get people that are going to let their words mean something, where their yay is yay and their nay is nay. You have to have people that are going to let their words mean exactly what they say.
I talked with Samuel about the tour and why it's called the Basics Bus Tour. I talked about how we're spreading the word about the vision, work, and revolutionary leadership of Bob Avakian and why that's so critically important today. I asked Samuel if he ever thought of revolution. He hesitated for a minute and then replied,
No, I haven't thought about revolution. I've thought about change, but as far as revolution is concerned and about changing the system, I think the system works, but it works for people who know how to work the system.
What if I was to say to you, the system was working when it took 6 weeks to charge Zimmerman? The system was working when it puts 2.4 million people in jail and more than half of them black.
Well, that's why I say the system works for those who know how to work the system. If we get more people into the system and to know how to work the system, then the system will work for us as well. I believe that we can change things, but the change has to come not only with our vote, but with our way of thinking. Knowledge is power.
It was coming up on dinner time, and Samuel's kids were kind of insisting that he come inside so they could eat. As he stepped back into his house, he turned and said that he doesn't buy into communism, because as far as he can tell, it hasn't worked. And with that, he was gone. I saw Samuel the next day as we started to march through his neighborhood down to the speak out at the Sanford Police Station. Samuel was watching and listening, and as he was heading back into his house, he came over and asked me if I had any more of those cards with Basics 113 on them. I handed him one, he smiled, and said he wanted to think about that for a while. Bicycles are a popular way of getting around in Goldsboro. It's flat and a relatively small area, so people take advantage of it. Lots of old cruisers with big fat tires and fenders. As I walked towards the bus after my conversation with Samuel, the man on the bicycle passed by again. This time he stopped to read the banners on the bus before heading off deeper into the hood. I was watching him and almost walked into another bicycle rider on the street. I jumped when I heard a young woman yell, "Excuse me!" in total frustration with my not watching where I was going. She stomped back hard on the pedal brakes and stopped an inch away from my leg. Her name was Lala, and she quickly let me know that I was going to get run over if I didn't pay attention. I apologized, and she asked me if I was with the big old RV on the corner with all the banners and the sound system. I said I was and explained who we were and what we were doing there. I asked her about her thoughts on what happened to Trayvon Martin.
I think that it's cruel. I think that it's selfish. I feel like that they're not really doing nothing. I think they're just letting it go just because of his mother and his father and what they're known for. He's a judge and she's work at the courthouse, and she can do. I feel like if you have money, you can do whatever you want to do. Basically, that's what I feel about the whole situation.
I read Basics 113 to Lala, and she took the card to read for herself.
I feel the same way that he feel, and not only for Trayvon, but I feel it for the other people that's in the community that got killed by the police.
Lala thought hard for a minute. It was like she wanted to be certain she would use the words she needed to use in order to make her point.
And it's like now that all of this is going on, like the people of the community, it's like we get treated like poorly and nasty and disgusted just because what's going on about Trayvon. I'm glad that, you know, that not somebody to lose their life, but I'm glad that it's kind of, they're picking up on it. It's not just behind, you know, now people starting to understand and people are seeing it more, and it's sad that it had to be a 17-year-old boy that get killed for something to happen. But my friend was 16 years old and he got shot from behind. He was driving in stolen cars or whatever. He was leaving, the security guard shot him from behind and he died. He died, and there's nothing that we could do to bring him back. There's nothing that we can do, but we can try to speak for him, but not to say that just because we speak out for him that justice will be served, you know?
I showed Lala the photo collage of the We Say No More banner with Basics 113 on it and told her how many people all over the country were stepping up to stand with the people of Sanford. I told her that hundreds had signed this banner. And before I could finish, Lala proudly said,
"And I'm one." It feel good to have somebody behind you and to have somebody, you know, that feel the same way that you feel instead of you by yourself. When you by yourself, no one to hear you, but with 1,000 more people behind you, a lot of people gonna hear you. So it feel good to have somebody by your side that'll help you through it. It does, to have somebody that's here. I'm glad that all this is going on. I really am, because I'm sick of it. I'm just 23 years old, and I'm sick of all of this that's going on in Sanford that I don't see in the 23 years of my life. I'm tired of it.
It was getting close to the time we had set to leave the neighborhood, and Lala said she had things to do. I wanted to ask Lala if she ever thought about revolution and being part of the movement for revolution. She said she hadn't, but she thought that it was kind of like everything happening today is in the Bible. We kicked religion around for a bit, And Lala was really intrigued by the idea that religion promotes a slave mentality that'll keep people in chains. I asked Lala again what she would say if she was asked how she could be a part of this movement for revolution. Lala got a huge, but suddenly very shy, smile and said,
I'll be trying to get ready. I can't say, you know, but I'm just happy that the movement is going. I'm very happy that the movement is going.
Her friends called out from down the street, and Lala reached out for a handful of the Join Us 12 Ways That You Can Be Part of Building the Movement for Revolution Right Now cards. She took off down the street on her bike, yelling out the longest thank you imaginable, and then letting loose with a loud, long laugh. All right, that just about wraps up another edition of the show. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my guests for today, Dr. Christian Head, the people of Sanford, Florida, and each and every one of you for tuning in. I also want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, and my production assistant, Henry Carson. And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And remember, American lives are not more important than other people's lives. And internationalism, the whole world comes first. All right, and those are from Bob Avakian and his book Basics, and keep them in mind as you're out there and that all that red, white, and blue nonsense is on steroids screwing up the world this week. We're going to go out now with one of my favorite songs from Lily Hayden, Children of Babylon.
Go on.